it felt in a weird way, kind of a tiny, tiny rebellion against my like Jewish upbringing to like learn about Christianity and learn about what other people were doing.
That voice belongs to Sherry Rabin. She is the chair of the Jewish Studies Department at Oberlin College in Ohio. And Dr. Rabin was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but on the day after her bat mitzvah at age 13, her parents moved to Marietta, Georgia. And that was in the year 2000. 9 years later, Rabin headed to Boston University for college, and then she earned her master's and doctoral degrees at Yale. After that came her return to the South, where she helped shape the College of Charleston's Perlstein-Lipov Center for Southern Jewish Culture into one of the most important places in our region for the study of the Jewish South. And those two long stretches of Southern life shaped her work and her outlook, her curiosity about how Jewish religious life takes root in places where people might be surprised to find it, like the American South. Last year, Dr. Rabin published an important book called The Jewish South and American History. Reading it convinced me of something I had not fully understood before. The story most of us were taught about how the South came to be the South, a story about white Protestants and black people, about plantations and churches, about cotton and Jesus, that story is incomplete, and the missing pieces matter. Because you cannot tell the truth about how this region was built without telling the truth about three forces that were never separate down here: race, religion, and money. They have always operated together. They have always shaped one another. And to see how, you have to look at the people who lived at the seam where all three pressed against each other. And that is where the Jews of the South lived for more than 300 years. They were here in colonial Charleston before the Carolina colony even had a charter. They were here in the slave markets and the dry goods stores. They were here in Confederate uniforms, and they were here in the mobs that overturned elected black governments after the Civil War. They were here when a Jewish man named Leo Frank was dragged out of a Georgia prison and lynched in 1915. They were here when a rabbi's house in Jackson, Mississippi was bombed in 1967. Because he believed black people belonged in his synagogue. The Jewish story is not a footnote to the Southern story. It is one of the truest waves into it. Today, with the help of Sherry Rabin and another very special guest, we're going to walk into that story together. I'm Chuck Reese, and welcome to Salvation South Deluxe. When I called Marcy Cohen Ferris last year and asked her to sit down with Sherry Rabin and talk about her book, The Jewish South, I knew I was making the right call. The two of them already knew each other. They had been in each other's professional lives for years. And Marcy is, by any honest reckoning, one of the most important historians of the Jewish South alive today. She is a born and raised Arkansan who has spent more than 40 years telling the story of this region through its kitchens and dinner tables, especially the intertwined traditions of Southern and Jewish foodways. She is the interim director of the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her books include The Edible South and Matzo Ball Gumbo, both of which use food as a way to understand identity, power, and belonging in this complicated region. So what you are about to hear is a conversation between two scholars about Sherry Rabin's book. My job today is to step in between their exchanges every so often to clarify a term, to fill in a piece of history, to read a passage from Rabin's book that helps you understand this story. So let's begin where Marcy began. She wanted to understand the lens Rabin was using to look at the Jewish South. And the term Rabin uses for that lens is one we need to define before we go any further. Here's Marcy.
So you use a term religio-racial kind of positioning of Jewish Southerners, and also say that a focus on the American South, quote, makes it impossible to ignore what narratives centered on Northern places might elide, namely the centrality of race and violence to American Jewish history. And that's another whole giant everything about the Jewish South, right?
Yeah, and I'll say the religio-racial comes from a religious studies scholar named Judith Weisenfeld, who's done really important work in the 20th century. But it helps us see how sort of intertwined and inextricable race and religion are. I don't think the South is utterly distinctive, but I think there are things in the South that are easier to see these threads of, you know, of anti-Black racism, violence, right? This is some of the most violent moments in American Jewish history, the most violent anti-Semitism, the lynching of Leo Frank, the bombings of synagogues. Those have happened here too. And, you know, when those are sort of at the center of the narrative and not sort of on the side, it sort of gives you a different perspective on sort of what the dynamics have been.
Religio-racial, race and religion as one indivisible thing, not two separate ones. That is the lens. And the scholar whom Rabin credits for the term, Judith Weisenfeld of Princeton University, argues that in America, you cannot really study one without the other. Religion and race were woven together from the beginning. That is true everywhere in this country, but it is especially true and especially visible in the South. And the Jewish people have been part of the South's story from the start. Here's Sherry Rabin again.
The way I start the book is with the Fundamental Constitutions of Carolina in 1669, which I've become obsessed with, which are kind of remarkable because it's a founding colonial document that imagines Jews as a presence in an American colony, even before the colony is established. It offers freedom of worship to Jews, heathens, and other dissenters from the purity of the Christian religion. So that's 1669. You start to see in Carolina sort of mentions of individual Jews in the 1690s. And then by 1749, there's enough in Charleston to create a synagogue. In the meantime, there's this whole other kind of wave, a group that goes to Savannah. And so Savannah, it was a group that was sent by the Jewish community of London to settle in this new colony that was set up for, you know, people who were being persecuted religiously in Europe. So they settle in 1733.
Stop and consider what Sherry just said. In 1669, more than 100 years before there was a United States, the founding document of the Carolina colony already imagined Jews living there. Jews were written into the South before the South was the South. But notice the language. Freedom to worship to Jews, heathens, and other dissenters from the purity of the Christian religion. The same document that welcomed Jews also ranked them, placed them outside the purity it imagined for itself. That is the deal that the South offered Jews from the beginning. You are welcome here. You are also not quite us. And there was a second part of the deal that the welcoming language does not name out loud. Within a few decades, Charleston would become one of the largest slave markets in North America. The Jews who arrived in Charleston and Savannah arrived into an economy built on the bondage of African people. They did not build that economy, but they joined it. And this is a part of the story where I need to be careful and where Rabin herself is very careful. So let me read you what she writes in the early pages of her book. And I quote, "To be clear, Jews did not originate, innovate, or dominate chattel slavery in the Americas. Slavery was the context in which Jews most clearly acted and were accepted as white Southerners. They continue to participate in every aspect of slavery." Now, let's be clear about this. did not originate, did not innovate, did not dominate, but participated in every aspect. And what does that participation look like up close? It looks like a man named Jacob Olivera. Olivera came to the Americas in 1733, first to Savannah, and then he later moved to Charleston. On July 21st, 1751, Olivera sat down to dictate his last will and testament. Here is a passage from that will, which Rabin quotes in her book. "I recommend to my son to walk in the fear of God and in the path of virtue, which is the last and best legacy I can leave him." That same will, a little further down, bequeaths to the same son half of Olivera's financial assets and, I quote, "my Negro boy named Jones." It's a father blessing his son. In one breath, the fear of God and the path of virtue. In the next breath, a human being owned and passed down like silver. That is the religio-racial braid Weisenfeld and Rabin are talking about, right there in one document in 1751. And Jacob Olivera was not unusual. He lived in the city of Charleston, and the number of people he enslaved was, in Rabin's words, quote, "modest compared to the grand country planters," close quote. In other words, Olivera was ordinary. That is the point. Across the colonial and antebellum South, Jewish families participated in slavery the same way their Christian neighbors did, owning, buying, selling, bequeathing. And in doing so, they were making a quiet trade. They were buying their way into the only category that mattered in the South, whiteness. Marcy Ferris knows this picture is not simple, not at all. Here she is.
You bring a lot of nuance, which helps your readers understand people as people. Not all Jews in the South were slaveholders. Not all Jews supported the Confederacy. Not all supported the Union. Like they were just like us, but different, you know, in this, with the mentality of people, you know, that living in this very racialized economy.
A racialized economy and a capitalist system. Marcy names both of them in the same sentence because in the South they were the same system. You could not separate them, and Jewish Southerners, like every other group of Southerners, moved through that system making choices. By the 1850s, those choices had hardened into divisive politics. And to understand those politics, you have to know one thing about the political parties of the 19th century. They were nearly the opposite of what we know today. Here is Marcy asking Rabin about Rabbi Isaac Meyer Wise, the architect of American Reform Judaism, who immigrated to Cincinnati from Moravia in 1846.
You point out that Isaac Meyer Wise was a Democrat, right?
Yeah. He was a unionist, but he was very sympathetic to the slaveholding South. He was in Cincinnati, border city. He's is an important leader, crucial in the development of American Reform Judaism, but certainly had what many of us would see as troubling racial and political ideas.
Because they explain to the Democratic and Republican parties were really reversed in how we think about them today.
Sure, right. In the 19th century, the Democratic Party was more closely aligned with the slaveholding South, you know, before the Civil War. And then after the Civil War, they were, you know, amongst those trying to push back on the gains of citizenship that had been granted to freed people. That was the more dominant, widespread kind of white Southern aristocratic party, and Wise, amongst many other Jews, Northern and Southern, tended to be allied with them.
I hope you listen to that carefully. The most important Reform rabbi in 19th century America, a man whose theological liberalism changed how American Jews still worship today, was politically aligned with the party of slavery, and after the war, the party of rolling back black citizenship. That is not a contradiction. It is the bargain working as designed. The privileges of whiteness in exchange for silence, or worse, on race. And the bargain did not end when the Confederacy lost. It continued. During the Reconstruction period after the Civil War, black Southerners were winning elected office. On November 10, 1898, in Wilmington, North Carolina, a mob of white agitators overthrew the elected multiracial government of that city. It was the only successful coup d'etat in American history. They burned the offices of the black-owned newspaper. They murdered black citizens in the streets. They drove the elected officials out of town at gunpoint. And here's Marcy naming what the historical record shows about who was in that mob.
It's interesting when you look at like the Wilmington coup, you know, in North Carolina, right, in 1898, and you talk about how a lot of upstanding Jewish citizens, you know, were Democrats, you know, and pushed against black enfranchisement in the city.
A lot of upstanding Jewish citizens marching with the mob, pushing against black enfranchisement. In her book, Sherry Rabin writes plainly that when the white mob overturned Wilmington's elected government in 1898, Jews were among their number. That is what the bargain looked like a generation after the Confederate surrender at Appomattox. Whiteness still being purchased, still being paid for by somebody. And then, in 1915, the bill came due. I want you to picture a place, Marietta, Georgia, about 20 miles north of downtown Atlanta. And if you have driven I-75 between Atlanta and Chattanooga, you have driven right past it. It is the town where Sherry Rabin's family moved when she was 13 years old. It is also where, on the night of August 16, 1915, a lynch mob drove down to Milledgeville, kidnapped a Jewish factory superintendent named Leo Frank from the state prison, and drove him back up to Marietta. About 30 white men carried out the lynching, a roster that included former Georgia Governor Joseph M. Brown, who helped plan it, the sitting mayor of Marietta, E.P. Dobbs, who lent his car to the convoy, and the sitting sheriff of Cobb County, George Swanson, who rode with the party that pulled Leo Frank from his cell. And at dawn on August 17th, they hanged him from an oak tree. Leo Frank had been convicted in 1913 of murdering a 13-year-old girl named Mary Fagan in the National Pencil Factory in Atlanta, which Frank ran. But the evidence against him was thin, and the trial was a circus of anti-Semitic mob pressure. The governor of Georgia, John Slayton, after reviewing the case, commuted Leo Frank's sentence from death to life imprisonment. But that decision so incensed white anti-Semitic leaders in Georgia that it effectively ended Slayton's political career and required him to flee the state. Fearing for his family's safety, he did not return to Georgia for 10 years. 2 months after that commutation, the mob came for Leo Frank in the night. Here is Sherry Rabin talking about why Leo Frank's lynching is the moment where the whole religio-racial dynamic she has been describing comes apart in public.
In the early 20th century moment that leads up to the lynching of Leo Frank, right, you see a couple different things, right? The mass migration of Eastern European Jews who, you know, are very visible sort of immigrant presence. And I think throughout a lot of this history, sort of like where does the nativism stop and the anti-Semitism begin is very fuzzy. It's all sort of, it's hard to disentangle. And then you also have this sort of emergence in the late 19th century of this new form of quote unquote scientific racial thinking that then also tells people like, oh, and Jews are also a part of the Semitic race that is fundamentally different from the Caucasian, you know, white ruling majority. So there's this coalescence of that. And then also, you know, in Leo Frank's Atlanta, the sort of dramatic economic and social changes associated with the New South, with industrialization. He's running a factory with like children working in it, right? That's part of like these broader economic changes that lead to a lot of suffering and anger and animosity. And sort of that context sort of melds with these sort of interwoven forms of Jewish difference to sort of lead to anti-Semitism and ultimately to Frank's lynching.
Rabin just laid the whole episode out for you. Race, religion, and economics, all three braided together, all three converging on a single oak tree in Marietta, Georgia, as a summer day dawned in 1915. Whiteness, it turned out, was conditional. The deal could be revoked. And in Marietta in 1915, it was. But that is not where this story ends, because 43 years later, on the morning of October 12, 1958, a bundle of dynamite would detonate at a Reform synagogue called the Temple on Peachtree Street in Atlanta. And then, in the years that followed, more bombs would come. In Jackson, Mississippi, the home and synagogue of a rabbi named Perry Nussbaum would be bombed by white supremacists in the same year, 1967, when he was wrestling with whether black Jews could be members of his congregation. The bombs that came for Southern Jews in the 1950s and 1960s were the grandchildren of the rope that hung Leo Frank. When we come back from this break, we'll talk about why those bombs came and about the small number of Southern rabbis who saw them coming and stood up anyway. In the early hours of a Sunday morning, October 12, 1958, 50 sticks of dynamite went off in a recessed entranceway at the Temple on Peachtree Street, the home of the oldest Jewish congregation in Atlanta. Nobody was inside, nobody was killed, but the blast tore through offices and mangled a staircase and shook the city's confidence so hard that Atlanta, which liked to call itself the city too busy to hate, had to look up from its desk and admit that some of its citizens had made the time to hate anyway. 43 years after the rope came for Leo Frank, the bombs had started to come. The Temple was led back then by a rabbi from Pittsburgh named Jacob Rothschild. He had taken that pulpit in 1946, and from his very first Yom Kippur sermon, he had been telling his Atlanta congregation that segregation was a sin. And a lot of his congregants didn't want to hear that. Most of them had spent their lives doing what Sherry Rabin's book describes as the long, careful work of becoming white Southerners. Their parents and grandparents had spent their lives doing the same. They had paid the price of admission. They had voted Democratic and donated to the right charities and made themselves indispensable on main streets across the South, from Norfolk to New Orleans. And on the morning of October 12th, they woke up to discover that 50 sticks of dynamite did not care how much work they had done. In the second part of the special Salvation South Deluxe, we tell the story of what they did next. We left Act One with Marcy Ferris saying that Jews in the South were never entirely insiders and never entirely outsiders, that they were witnesses. Here's how she put it in her conversation with Sherry Rabin.
Their position is both insider, outsider, mean that we can go alongside them as we do in your book and really understand the South in far more different and complex ways. They're great witnesses to privilege and persecution, as you say, on all sides. They're as guilty and as innocent as any Southerner that have lived in throughout these times.
As guilty and as innocent as any Southerner. That is the sentence that runs underneath everything we are about to tell you. Because what Sherry Rabin found when she looked deeply into how Southern Jews behaved during the long civil rights movement was not a story of crusaders, nor was it a story of opponents. It was the story of a community that was divided right down the middle. Here is how she writes it in her book. And I quote, "As black citizens intensified their demands for equality, most Southern Jews would prove neither heroes nor villains. While some stood bravely in support of black civil rights, drawing especially on resources from Reformed Jewish thought, most were willing to abide racial injustice in the hopes, however misguided, of protecting their hard-won status as white Southerners." And that is the truth Rabin's book asks us to sit with. Because the price of admission to Southern whiteness, which Jews had been paying for 2.5 centuries by the time Rosa Parks refused to relinquish her seat on a Montgomery City bus, that price had not stopped being collected. And in the years between Brown versus Board of Education and the Voting Rights Act, the bill came due. Let's start with the majority, the cautious majority, the Jews who, when desegregation came to the schoolhouse and to the lunch counter and finally to the synagogue door, looked for a way to say, "This is not our fight." Here's Rabin describing how that argument typically sounded.
I think in a lot of places after that question came up, you know, in certain communities, there was a tendency of people to say like, "Oh, this is a Christian or American issue. It's not a Jewish issue. We'll go like, you know, build up our Sunday school or whatever."
A Christian issue, an American issue, but not a Jewish issue. You can hear inside that sentence 250 years of cautious accommodation. And you can hear in that caution their fear. These were people whose cousins in Europe had died in Nazi concentration camps. In her book, Sherry Rabin named Southern Jewish leaders who actively opposed the integration of schools. And she writes about them honestly. In South Carolina, the Speaker of the State House was a Jewish man named Solomon Blatt. In 1951, Blatt threw his full support behind a constitutional amendment that would have repealed compulsory school attendance in South Carolina rather than allow black children into white schools, and he kept fighting for segregation into the 1960s. In Georgia, a Macon attorney named Charles J. Block defended segregation in court for decades and even testified before Congress against the Civil Rights Act of 1957. In Selma, Alabama, a Jewish man named Saul Tepper was a close ally of Sheriff Big Jim Clark, the same Jim Clark whose troopers beat John Lewis and Hosea Williams half to death on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. These were not fringe figures. Blatt was the most powerful man in the South Carolina legislature for a generation. They were all Southern Jews who had decided that the whiteness they had purchased was worth more than the Judaism they had inherited. Most Southern Jews were not Solomon Blatt, but neither were they part of a brave minority. But after the Temple bombing in Atlanta in 1958, a brave minority of Jewish leaders began to rise and fight for civil rights. In Atlanta, the Temple's rabbi, Jacob Rothschild, kept right on preaching after the rubble was cleared. He went on in the years that followed to become a close personal friend of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Rabbi Rothschild even helped plan the dinner that the city of Atlanta held in 1965 to honor Dr. King receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, a dinner that almost didn't happen because Atlanta's white business leaders were scared to be photographed at it. And in Jackson, Mississippi, Rabbi Perry Nussbaum drove 150 miles every week to the state penitentiary, Parchman Farm, to bring books and letters and human contact to the freedom riders who had been arrested and were being held there. Nussbaum held the first interracial service in the state of Mississippi. He wrote in 1955, asking his rabbinic colleagues across the country what he should do if a black Jewish couple applied for membership in his congregation. Here's Rabin describing what Nussbaum wrote.
I found this amazing set of letters responding to a sort of formal rabbinic query from Rabbi Perry Nussbaum, one of the sort of most famous rabbis who was supportive of black civil rights in Jackson, Mississippi. In this letter, Nussbaum says, "What do I do if there's an interracial Jewish couple, a white man and his black wife who converted to Judaism? What if they apply for membership in our synagogue and the board of trustees of the congregation reject them? What do I do?"
Nussbaum answered his own question by saying, yes, black Jews were Jews. They could not be turned away. And then white supremacists bombed Rabbi Nussbaum's home in Jackson in 1967. Rabbi Burton Padal watched the scions of old Charleston Jewish families walk out of his Kahal Kadosh Beth Elohim congregation in Charleston when he delivered sermons calling for school integration. Rabbi Joachim Prinz, who came to America after the Nazis expelled him from Germany in 1939, spoke alongside Martin Luther King at the March on Washington in 1963. And in his speech, Rabbi Prinz drew parallels between the plight of black Southerners and his own experience under the Nazis. These were not the rabbis of a community in agreement. Their own congregants, the people who paid their salaries, frequently begged them to shut up. Rabbi Moses Landau of Cleveland, Mississippi, wrote a letter to Perry Nussbaum that captured the bind these men were in. Landau wrote, and I quote, "Hundreds of our families live isolated, two or three in a community, in an emotionally charged atmosphere. It is your privilege to be a martyr. There are dozens of vacant pulpits. You can pick yourself up within 24 hours and leave. Can you say the same about the 1,000 Jewish families in this state?" And that was the argument that the cautious majority used against the brave minority. And it wasn't really unreasonable. The bombs that came for Nussbaum's house and Rothschild's synagogues were proof. The Ku Klux Klan was watching. The white citizens' councils were watching. With the rise of anti-Semitism, Jews had every right to be afraid. But here is something we can say without question about the brave minority who fought for civil and voting rights for everyone. They were right. Which brings us, finally, to the question Marcy Ferris and Sherry Rabin posed at the beginning of this episode, the one we said we would carry all the way through. Did the struggle for black civil rights become the Jews' own struggle? The honest answer is yes, but mostly only when the violence came home to them. The white leaders of Atlanta had not risen in protest as black churches were bombed or burned to the ground during the civil rights movement. But the temple bombing changed Atlanta fundamentally because a white religious building had been hit. The outrage over the bombing wasn't confined to Atlanta or even the broader South. There was an FBI investigation. Hate crimes legislation was proposed. But, as Rabin writes, and I'm quoting from her book here, black Southerners complained that similar outrage had been absent in the far more widespread bombings of black churches and homes, close quote. And it is a question that hangs over the whole second half of the 20th century in the American South. It's a question that the brave minority, Rothschild and Nussbaum and Padal and others, have been trying to answer with their words and in their lives before the bombs went off. They had been arguing that the rope that came for Leo Frank in 1915 and the bombs that came for the temple in 1958 and Nussbaum's home and synagogue in 1967 were fruit of the same poisoned tree. That the white supremacy that murdered black men in the cotton fields was the same white supremacy that lynched a Jewish man in Marietta. That a Southern Jew who looked the other way when a black neighbor was lynched was, in the end, only buying himself a little more time. The book Sherry Rabin wrote is called The Jewish South. It is, as Marcy Ferris tells her on the recording you've been listening to, the first full-length history of the broad sweep of Jewish life in the American South, from the 17th century to the 20th, from the colonies to the civil rights movement. 300 years of arrival, accommodation, ambition, fear, and witness. What it tells us in the end is what Marcy Ferris said, Jews in the South were as guilty and as innocent as any other Southerners. They were also, in my view, a mirror of the entire region. Jews came to the South and built businesses and synagogues. Some owned other human beings and fought for the Confederacy, while others were beaten and bombed and lynched. They were, in other words, Southerners. And the South, the real South, the whole South, the region we try to tell the truth about here at Salvation South, does not exist without them. A note about how we made this episode. Every word you have heard from Sherry Rabin and Marcy Ferris was spoken by them in their conversation on a single recording. We have not stitched their sentences together. We have put no words in their mouths. The passages that I read from Sherry's book were read with her permission and identified to you as such. We thank Marcy Ferris, who has spent her career making Southern Jewish history visible. I am so grateful to call her my friend, and she has taught me much about the South that I might never have understood without her. And we thank Sherry Rabin, whose extraordinary book, The Jewish South, is available everywhere you buy books. If you have been moved by anything you heard on this episode, please buy it, read it, lend it, argue with it. That is what a good history is for. You've been listening to Salvation South Deluxe, proudly produced in cooperation with Georgia Public Broadcasting and its network of 20 stations around our state. Every week, we add a short commentary about Southern stuff to our podcast feed, and every month or so, we add a longer, deluxe story such as the one we've just told you. I'm Chuck Reese, your host and the editor-in-chief of Salvation South, which you can visit 24/7 at salvationsouth.com. We publish a new issue of Southern Writing every Sunday. Our producer is Miranda Hawkins. Our audio engineer is Mark Davenport. GPB's director of podcasts is Jeremy Powell. And we tip our hats to GPB's president and CEO, Bert Wesley Huffman, and senior vice president for content, Sandy Malcolm. Their support for Salvation South's mission to give voice to the many untold stories of this region has been steadfast, and we are so grateful for it. And we'll be back next month with another full-length episode of the Salvation South podcast.